Hello, Gabriel.
Hi there.
This is Con Carroll. I'm the official editor for the Heritage Foundation's blog, The Foundry, and I am with...
Gabriel Arana, and I'm the assistant web editor at the American Prospect magazine.
Great, and we are filming on Monday, December 20th, Christmas season, and there still is a lame duck session going on that is producing lots of news and some new legislation. The issue that matters much more to you than to me passed this weekend, so I'll let you start off.
Sure. So this past weekend, the Senate passed a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the ban on openly gay military service. And I guess from my point of view, Don't Ask, Don't Tell has always been a proxy battle for the culture war. From what I can tell, it's mattered to conservatives much less in and of itself than in that it represents the normalization of homosexuality, in the culture at large, in society. I'm not sure, how you feel about that, what your thoughts on it are.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. I was surprised at the fight that was actually put up by McCain and Graham, mm-hmm. and the rest of them. Just following my tweets, it would seem like the entire conservative world was really pushing hard on the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But if you look at it, other than the Family Research Council, I can't think of any organizations on the conservative right side that were fighting against this repeal. Heritage Foundation did not have a position on it. I don't think AEI did either. I don't know if Cato did, but if they did, it would be on repeal side. Mm-hmm. So it was really kind of a non-entity for the vast majority of the right.
Although the Heritage Foundation did express some concerns about the effect that Don't Ask, Don't Tell would have on religious liberty.
Yes. There are some religious liberty aspects we have, but those... I don't know if we've written ever specifically on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I could be wrong. I've never blogged on it. We have done a lot of work on marriage and how changing the definition of marriage is an assault on religious liberty. But that's a different issue than the Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Well, I think with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, from what I read on your website, the concern was, whether chaplains in the military would be able to, express disapproval of homosexuality, or whether, there would be some reprisal for, expressing, views against homosexuality.
Yeah, do you have any credence to those concerns?
I guess... I don't really see there being a reason to, for concern. I think, insofar as the law is concerned, there are really no repercussions for chaplains in the military that I know of. This is why I was curious, to hear your thoughts on it. There really are no repercussions for disagreeing with, homosexuality. I think that these fears about religious liberty are sort of unfounded, at least when it comes to Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Well, I mean, I am not familiar with, how such an order would be carried out, but it seems to me that if one was in charge of implementing this policy, that one would want to make sure that all of the soldiers were on board with it, and if one of these soldiers was, because of their religious views and their status as a chaplain, were espousing beliefs and ideas that were in direct contradiction of it, that would seem to me to be subordination, would seem to be problematic. How do you solve that problem?
Well, I think that, I don't know how many service members go around, talking about homosexuality, but I mean, I really think, and it's not that I think that, homosexuality and adultery are analogous in any way, but, people disapprove, of adultery, you know, on moral grounds, and they may also disapprove of homosexuality on moral grounds. And to me, it seems like, you know, it's not been a problem for the in the military for, you know, there to be soldiers who commit adultery and also have soldiers who disapprove of adultery.
But committing adultery is very much against military policy. You can be severely punished for committing adultery.
In the service.
Yeah, if you're in the service and you commit adultery, especially with, you know, another serviceman's spouse, that is grounds for severe punishment.
Well, I mean, I see, you know, but not, you know, not during active military service. I mean, even if your private life, you know, in your private life, you know, say you've committed adultery. I mean, is it also the case that, I mean, you can be denied admission to the military, or, you know, I can see it being an issue if you're, you know, sleeping with a fellow service member's spouse.
If you're trying to get promoted within the military and you have it on your record that you have committed adultery, yeah, that's not going to fly.
I mean, I guess I guess maybe I have to plead ignorance on this point that, you know, like I'm not aware of people being held back from promotions, you know, based on whether, you know, they commit adultery or not. You know, but you might know better than I do.
No, I'm not. I do not have the U.S. Military Code of Justice with me, neither do I know it backwards or forwards. But I am pretty sure that adultery is not tolerated. Let's put it that way. Adultery is not tolerated within the service.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, my overall point is that, you know, I think that, you know, military and, you know, in the line of duty, you know, isn't really the time to espouse beliefs, you know, to espouse moral beliefs. I mean, you have a job to do, and I think that should be the focus. And I think that, you know, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal was really about putting the focus back on, you know, what matters, which is how well, how well or not, you know, troops are able to perform their duties, as opposed to, you know, factors like sexuality that have no bearing on somebody's ability to, you know, to fight well, and, you know, in the instance of Dan Choi, to translate documents, you know, to help develop intel for the military. I mean, I think that, you know, the reason that, you know, lefties see it as, you know, a triumph is that, you know, not that it puts, you know, homosexuality or sexuality front and center, but that it really allows it to go into the background and to allow gay service members and straight service members alike to perform their duties. I mean, I think it's been an incredible distraction. You know, people talk about how, you know, McCain was saying that, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, would distract people, or having it repealed would distract people on the battlefield. But I really think that, you know, the entire fiasco over this, you know, discriminatory, you know, piece of legislation, a holdover from the 90s, you know, has really distracted the military from doing its job.
I guess I would disagree. I think that most people in the military are not distracted by the Don't Ask, Don't Tell gay issue at all. That doesn't come into factor when they're being deployed or even when they're home. And I don't think that they're fixated on it the same way that lefty elites are fixated on it. I don't think the American people care much. When they do bother to care a little bit, they're you know, kind of for it. But I don't think the military's been distracted at all.
I mean, you're saying that Americans are for it.
I think that, you know, it is going to take effort, and there are going to be growing pains in implementing it. And that is going to be another challenge for the military. I think every report said that. You know, but, you know, they're asked to do a lot of difficult things, and this is just, you know, pretty far down the list of difficult things that they're going to have to be doing.
Mm. Yes, I mean, well, then at least we can both agree that it's pretty far down the list of difficult things that soldiers have to do while serving the country.
Yes. The Marines have to do many, many difficult things this is hardly one of them.
Mm. All right, so do you want to switch gears to the Dream Act?
Yes, yes. This one went less well for the left. The Dream Act went down. And if Harry Reid and the Democrats had been able to hold on to all of their Democratic votes, there was enough Republican votes for it to pass. But Harry Reid could not keep his caucus in order, and the Dream Act died. I think I've written about the Dream Act a lot, but I think you may have written on it more. Do you want to go ahead and talk about your reaction to the vote and perhaps what comes next?
Well, I think that I think the Dream Act was always a compromise. Democrats, liberals have been fighting for the entire time is, you know, what they call sort of euphemistically comprehensive immigration reform.
And the Dream Act was definitely not that.
No, it's not. I mean, what it would have done is provide a path to citizenship for the children of immigrants who came here illegally, granted that they serve in the military or attend 2 years of college.
Right, and let me just say for the record that there already is a way for the DHS secretary to naturalize people that serve in the military. So this would be an extra. The military piece is just thrown in there to make the cause more sympathetic. It's not necessary.
Mm-hmm. The goal has always been, you know, or for some time has been to pass, you know, like an omnibus immigration bill. That not only would provide a path to citizenship for, you know, the children of undocumented immigrants, but also for, people who came here without authorization or who overstayed visas. And this was really a compromise. And there was a lot of momentum behind it, a lot of organizing behind it on the left. And
a compromise between who?
It was a compromise between the Democratic leadership and immigrant rights advocates.
Okay. Because there was no extra enforcement in this bill. It wasn't like, we'll give amnesty to these people, but then we'll also do, we'll also make E-Verify national. There's no new enforcement in the bill. It was all just amnesty.
No, although, you know, I don't know how much more enforcement you could get.
Well, like I said, you could make E-Verify national policy. That'd be mm-hmm. one way to add more enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I think that the feeling was that, you know, this more enforcement would be part of a deal, you know, as part of an omnibus immigration bill.
Wasn't that. So this was a compromise between Senate leadership and amnesty advocates to give amnesty to the most sympathetic people possible.
Yes. I'd agree with that. I think it's really telling that, you know, that this is considered an amnesty. I mean, what it says, if you're saying that this is, you know, amnesty, which I would agree that it's a, you know, it's a form of amnesty, the underlying logic behind it is that it's actually easier to get a college degree than to become a citizen. And so I think that points to the real problem with the immigration system, which is that it's incredibly hard to become a U.S. citizen. And in some cases, I mean, depending on the country that you're coming from, you know, the wait can be 140 years. I think that it's really telling that there's so much opposition to this. I feel like people don't understand that. I mean, what this really says is that getting a college degree is a lot easier than becoming a citizen. And people pretend like all you have to do is get in line. But actually, you know, when liberals talk about the immigration system being broken, they don't mean that we don't have enough enforcement at the border. And I grew up on the U.S.-Mexico border. And I mean, from you know, from my point of view, I don't think we need any more enforcement there. You know, but that, you know, the real problem is that it's incredibly difficult to become a citizen. You know, Iceland, which has 200,000 people, has the same, has the same quota as Mexico, which has, you know, millions of people. So I think that when people talk about the immigration system being broken, they seldom acknowledge that it's actually, you know, the laws that we have don't reflect the economic reality. And because of that, I mean, that's in my view, you know, the reason that you have, you know, this large, you know, segment of, you know, this large number of undocumented immigrants.
Yeah. Well, I would first agree with you. I don't think anyone in this country believes that our immigration system works. Everyone believes it's broken. I saw you're from, Nogales, right?
Yep.
I was down in Nogales for a field hearing after 9/11. We were doing field hearings around the country. I was working for a House Oversight Committee, and so we did a field hearing down in Nogales. And the ranchers there and the property owners definitely feel the immigration system is broken, because you know they go out there and they try to have raise cattle, and they have fences that keep getting broken over and broken into. This is, you know, not just people who own land on the border, but people inland where there are different drop sites and the rest of it. And you have illegal immigrants leaving refuse and human waste on their land, on their property, sickening their cows. Cows are running all over the place because the fences have been broken down for paths. So there is a sense of lawlessness on the border that the people down there feel and are sick and tired of. And that's, you know, not even starting to talk about the rest of the country, which is seeing an influx of illegal immigrants. So yeah, no one really likes the current system. You know, and you're right, it does take, you know, far too long for far too many people to become citizens. You know, and so the question really is, you know, how do we want to change the system we have? And I think, you know, there is just a fundamental difference between, you know, a kind of growing conservative consensus on immigration policy and what you see coming out of not just the left, you know, but, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the Bush administration, of course, was much more in the line of giving amnesty to people that have it now. Whereas if you look at, you know, what Heritage is calling for as far as more H-1B visas, more higher quotas for countries with skilled people. You know, I think what you have to look at is, you know, over the past, you know, let's say since 86, since the last amnesty, you know, you have 11 million new illegal immigrants here. So the question is, you know, 20 years from now, what group of people do we want to let into the country? Do we want to have another 11 million illiterate non-English speakers, or do we want to have 11 million people that are diverse, come from Eastern Europe, from India, from Korea, Japan, that speak English and have advanced degrees? And you know, I think that's the coming debate that you're going to see start in the next Congress and really really continue into 2012. What type of immigration reform do we want to see?
So are you concerned that, you know, there are too many... So are you concerned, you know, with the type of people who are let in? I mean, that seems to be the implication of what you're saying, that, you know, we don't want ignorant, non-English, you know... illiterate, non-English speakers coming into the country. I mean, first of all, before, you know, I started my life as a journalist, you know, I was doing a PhD in linguistics, and one of the basic facts about, you know, language learning, if that's such a concern, is that, you know, the children of immigrants grow up speaking English. You know, so, I mean, within a generation, you know, you don't have the language concern. And, you know, so then it seems much more of a class concern that you're worried that there are too many poor people coming to the country.
Yeah, no, that's definitely part of it. If you look at, you know, every time someone talks about how there's poverty growing in the country and the United States isn't as upwardly mobile as it used to be. A lot of that is because of the, I mean, they take that data from the 70s when there was next to no immigration, and then they compare that to the era since then when there's been a large influx of uneducated immigrants coming in. And that cohort definitely makes it harder to have an upwardly mobile, you know, creative, job creating society. So, you know, if you're going to look at, you know, which group of people is going to give the country a better chance to create more jobs and create, you know, more technology innovation jobs in the next century, I think it's going to be the cohort that already speaks English and has advanced degrees versus one that doesn't speak English and doesn't have a high school degree.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my view of the situation is that, you know, whether or not, you know, that there is a demand for this labor and that it's really, you know, an economic phenomenon, you know, and as long as there's a demand for this labor that's not being met, that you will have people willing, you know, to cross the border illegally.
No, you're right. They'll definitely take steps to make that demand harder. I mean, you were talking about Arizona before. Now, even before SB 1070 passed, Arizona has seen a stark decline in their illegal immigrant population. And that's because of enforcement measures like E-Verify, which the amnesty crowd is now challenging in the Supreme Court. And so what that does is that actually requires employers to verify that someone is a legal citizen. Now, if all of a sudden businesses, instead of having it in their business model that they can hire illegal immigrants and get away with it, if all of a sudden there were enforcement mechanisms to make it easier for businesses to comply with the law and make it easier for them to make sure that they were hiring legal citizens, that would decrease the demand for illegal immigrant labor.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, and that's part of the, you know, that's part of the trade-off of, you know, a comprehensive, you know, immigration reform bill is, you know, increased enforcement measures for, you know, like, you know, loosening the restrictions on immigration. But, you know, we've really been able to accomplish, you know, none of that. I mean, if anything, all we have gotten is increased enforcement. And actually, I mean, the majority of people who are here illegally actually come here legally and then overstay visas. So, I mean, especially when it comes to, you know, border enforcement, you know, I think that, I mean, first of all, I've said this for many years, you know, if you look at FBI crime data, you know, like the violence, you know, the epidemic of violence on the border is overhyped. I mean, and President Obama said this over the summer, that the border is actually safer than it has been in, you know, in a decade. You know, I think he said since, you know, like the 90s. I forget what the exact phrase is. But, you know, I just really don't think that there's this, you know, huge enforcement problem. I think that, you know, primarily what has been left undone is to relax these restrictions on immigration that make it so impossible to become a citizen. You know, and as you mentioned, it's not just, you know, like poor and educated immigrants, you know, who have trouble getting visas or, you know, like coming to the country. You know, I have, when I was doing a PhD, I have a lot of, you know, friends with advanced degrees who, you know, married somebody from, you know, Israel in one case or the UK in another. And, you know, instead of reside here, they actually choose to, you know, to relocate to Israel or to the UK because it is so difficult. I mean, even for very educated, very educated immigrants to obtain citizenship.
No, I have acquaintances who are, you know, from like Korea and Japan who speak English and have advanced degrees, and you know, their visas ran out and they very much wanted to stay here and keep working when, you know, one of them was in a startup company, but couldn't.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the prospects are for seeing, you know, some sort of comprehensive immigration reform bill, you know, sometime in, you know, in the next, 6 months?
In the next how long?
6 months.
Pretty low. I do think you're going to see movement by Peter King and some others to do some more enforcement measures, like along the lines of making e-verify national and some other steps along those lines. But as far as doing something to legalize the 10 million or so immigrants that are here illegally now, nothing.
What do you think the consequences politically for Republicans will be long term? There's a lot of talk about the Hispanic vote and how this opposition to immigration reform, except for putting drones on the border or stepping up the e-verify system, that it's really going to cost Republicans the Latino vote. I'm a regular reader of, a lot of Hispanic media, and, there's such a sense of anger at, both at the president for not being able to push through a comprehensive immigration reform bill, but also at Republicans for stonewalling, any reform other than, an increase in enforcement.
Yeah, no, I think... the calculus is that there is no upside to caving into amnesty. If you pass the DREAM Act, all that does is mean they want to give that's Luis Gutierrez says, that's opening up the door for an hour. Then they're going to want to open up for a day. They're going to want more. Short of purely open borders, you're just never going to be able to satisfy the La Raza crowd. So. There's never going to become a point where a John McCain or a Lindsey Graham can say, I believe in X, and that portion of the amnesty community is going to say, oh, okay, that's good enough. We're going to stop telling everyone that Republicans are evils, are evil racists. That's just never going to happen. Until there are purely open borders, that crowd is always going to hate on Republicans. And so there's just no upside to giving in to any of the amnesties.
I mean, I would have to disagree. President Bush, actually made inroads with, the Latino community by, supporting comprehensive immigration reform. And McCain used to. And
how'd they do?
What's that?
How'd Bush do after he tried to introduce amnesty?
I mean, I'm not saying, I'm saying, among the Latino community, it did help, it did help him curry favor with Latino voters. So I'm saying that you're saying there's no upside. I'm saying there is, I'm asking the question of, what are the long-term consequences of, Republican and conservative, across the board opposition to relaxing any immigration restrictions?
Well, no, I mean the long term, further than the next 6 months, 2 years, is to embrace more of a immigration strategy that I talked about before, is to make it easier for the dynamic and educated crowd from all over the world to come in and to sell it really as a jobs recruitment tool policy that will appeal to everyone, not just individual small population subgroups.
I mean, you're saying that, you're calling the Latino population small?
Well, the portion of it that is solely motivated by amnesty, yes. I think there is, even you can look at, I think it was actually Gallup, or no, it was Pew. It was Pew who did a poll recently, Hispanic Pew Center, who asked Latinos, Hispanics, whether or not they thought illegal immigration was good for the country, and they said no. Mm-hmm. It's not a monolithic community. So if the Republicans are able to show that they are not anti-immigrant, that they are open to other groups, and that they are interested in job creation, I do think that they will be able to make inroads into all communities, including the Latino community.
Well, I think, you know, by and large, the perception, you know, and I'm not saying that this will never change, you know, but I think that the perception, you know, if you look at the Hispanic media, you know, if you, and you know, I'm not talking about, you know, just people at La Raza, you know, I mean, people back home, you know, do perceive, you know, think, you know, measures like SB 1070, you know, and if you look at, you know, if you poll Latino voters on that, they do see it as a racially motivated attack. And, you know, I think that, you know, Republicans will really have to change course in order to change that perception.
Yeah, well, you know, my response to that is, you know, one election in Nevada, so you're having, you have the exact same electorate, and, you know, you have two votes. You have Sharon Engel, who did run a very divisive, you know, racist campaign. She lost against Harry Reid.
And Meg Whitman,
and then you
too.
Have the governor's race, where the Republican won, exact same electorate. So yeah, if you know if Republicans decide to run noxious ads like Sharon Engel and really play up the nativist angle and be really stupid about it, they're going to get their butts kicked for a really long time. Mm-hmm. But if they take a more inclusive, pro-growth approach, then I think they'll do just fine.
Alright. So now, I guess, onto the START Treaty, which is more your territory.
Yes, yes. We're taping this on Monday, and the vote's going to be Tuesday, so depending on what time they put this up, this may all be decided already. But basically, it comes down to 9 senators. Bob Bennett, Scott Brown, Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham, Dick Lugar, John McCain, Lisa Murkowski, Olympia Snow, and George Voinovich. Those are the 9 senators that voted last week to allow debate on START. And if all of those 9 senators that voted to allow debate also vote for passage, then New START will be ratified. So then the news over the weekend was that Lindsey Graham went on Face the Nation and said he would not vote for it. So that puts the START Treaty down 1. John McCain said he was undecided, so we'll call that a maybe. But then the White House issued a letter saying that they would promise to fully develop missile defense in Europe, and that made Bob Corker, who voted no on debate, made him say some things on the Senate floor that would make you think that he was now maybe on passage. So, by my somewhat informed but not insider account, the White House is down 1 vote, but they still have a good chance of peeling off Corker and getting it.
So didn't Graham say that he wasn't going to vote for START or to allow debate on START because of, well, so just to be clear, have they've already started debate on START and then they have to vote on ratification?
Right. Okay. So they started debate on Friday or Thursday? Mm-hmm. I think it was Thursday actually. So they've been debating it. Through the executive calendar, they had the DREAM Act and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And so they've been debating START throughout that. They debated it all day Sunday yesterday. They're going to be debating it today and the vote tomorrow.
So, and didn't Graham say that he wasn't going to vote for, you know, for START because he was mad about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, about the way, you know, like...
For Graham, it's all process. This is what his quote to Face the Nation. Mm-hmm. If you want to have a chance of passing START, you better start over and do it in the next Congress because this lame duck has been poisoned. And so he pointed to, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the DREAM Act as part of the poisoning. So Graham's opposition is pretty much all procedural.
Yeah, I mean, how do you feel? I mean, I always find these procedural, you know, grievances really silly. Because it seems like, you know, I would rather, you know, I guess, you know, just as an observer, I find, you know, arguments on the merits much more, you know, like, compelling than, you know, I don't like the way this went down, so I'm going to be a spoiler, you know, going forward.
It does have the ring of a 2-year-old, doesn't it? I'm going to take my ball and go home.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. No, you know, it's not it's not a very convincing argument. It's not, you know, if one was opposed to the New START Treaty and you were sitting at home thinking of arguments to make against it, the, you know, they didn't follow the right procedure and do everything I wanted to do the way I wanted them to do it, so I'm going to vote against it, is pretty far down on the list of arguments you'd make.
So, I mean, but basically you have, you know, this, I mean, START is, you know, by and large a Democratic measure. I mean, like, you're talking about, you know, 9 or 10 Republicans. You know, what's the opposition in, you know, like, the rest of the party to the START Treaty?
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, you know, for a long time, all the papers would cover was nuclear modernization. It was all about nuclear modernization, which, you know, is important, but is completely ancillary to START. Like, we need to make sure our nuclear weapons work and we have a good nuclear weapons infrastructure because we don't want our nuclear weapons to blow up on us, whether or not we have START or not. So it was always kind of a silly issue. I think for most conservatives, it was always missile defense. And it was only until really the last week that you finally saw, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times and the big dailies finally noticing that there were some missile defense concerns in this treaty.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess, you know, not to talk too much about process, but it just seems like nothing, you know, like the situation with START seems emblematic of, you know, the problem, you know, in the Senate, which is most Republicans don't want to do anything. And so you have to rely on, you know, those more toward the center, you know, in order to get anything done.
START's different than, you know, health care or DREAM Act or that, because, you know, it's in the Constitution. Treaties require not just 60, but 2/3. That's not some Senate rule created, mm-hmm. you know, recently. That's no, right in the Constitution itself.
Mm-hmm. No, yes. But I'm asking, you know, why is it so hard to get, you know, Republicans on board? I mean, because, again, it seems like, you know, no matter what the issue is, you know, and I mean, you know, practically now you need 2/3 of a vote, you know, to pass anything in the Senate. you know, I mean, it seems like, you know, you're ratifying a treaty, you know, whether you're voting on DREAM or
right. Well, you know, I think your simple answer is the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's talk about the DREAM Act. Let's talk about the fact that Orrin Hatch was one of the original co-sponsors of the bill, mm-hmm. and that he was dead set against the later version, even though the later version was a lot tighter than the one that he introduced. Mm-hmm. And why is Hatch behaving that way? Because his fellow senator from Utah, Bob Bennett, is going home this January because he got defeated in a primary. And so Orrin Hatch is very mindful of that and is behaving accordingly. You know, primaries are, you know, the reason why you're seeing, you know, Lindsey Graham and other more moderate usual suspects, even Bob Corker, etc., get to the right on a lot of these issues, because they know they have to stay right with their conservative base back home.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean I don't see how you could disagree with that analysis. Although, you know, I think, you know, like, my question is, you know, then, you know, like, how is this, you know, how are you supposed to move forward and actually govern? I mean, like, the Tea Party, which, you know, I would describe as, you know, like, a party born of resentment, you know, I mean, how, you know, like, how do you move forward and actually govern a country if, you know, like, the, you know, the platform is, you know, like, do nothing and, you know, obstruct?
We're going to find out really shortly. You know, I think the last item on our agenda, to fit in at the last second here, was the fight over the omnibus turned into continuing resolution. Continuing resolution, mm-hmm. and you know, that was a major victory for the Tea Party. You know, you had, on the one hand, you had Bob Bennett, who I mentioned before, on the phones trying to get all the appropriators in line to protect their earmarks and vote for the omnibus, and then you had Mitch McConnell and Jim DeMint on the other hand, you know, twisting the arms of the appropriators, saying, you know, the direction of the party is going this way, you're going to have to give up this way of doing business in Washington. And the Tea Party won that fight. It's going to be I think it was a precursor to what you're going to see happen with the debt ceiling. You know, around about April or May, the Treasury is going to run up next to our credit limit, and they're going to have to get Congress to up the debt ceiling so that we can borrow more money. And you're going to see the Tea Party, you know, push for some pretty strong conciliations from spenders in Washington. And I don't think there's going to be a government shutdown. I do think there's going to be a deal made that cuts spending. It'll be interesting to see what that deal looks like.
Mm-hmm. See, because, I mean, if you just look historically, you know, the rhetoric of, you know, cutting spending and cutting taxes, you know, like, is very popular. But, you know, what... You know, and whenever conservatives have been in power, they've cut taxes, but they have not cut spending. I mean, and, you know, like Reagan, you know, the hero of the right, you know, government actually grew, you know, not at the rate, you know, that it has grown since, you know, but government actually grew under President Reagan.
It did, but if you take out defense spending, it didn't. You know, and also if you look across the country, you see, you know, Chris Christie, you see Mitch Daniels. There are conservatives out there who have gotten elected on the state level and cut spending. You know, and now we have, you know, a Barack Obama presidential debt commission that has put the president's seal approval on a number of ways to cut spending, including cuts to, you know, Social Security and Medicare. So, you know, I think if you're a Tea Party reformer, you look at those cuts and that's your new baseline. You're going to negotiations saying, okay, we have here, you know, the president himself has an outline as to how we cut spending. You know, we'll allow you to borrow this money if you follow through with these cuts.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that there's... So, I mean, I think, you know, I think it's an incredibly bad idea to cut, you know, government spending, you know, while a recession is still going on. I mean, do you think there's any chance of there being, you know, there being a deal where, you know, you can cut spending, you know, at a future date? You know, because I think that, you know, like any pullback in, you know, government resources, you know, taking, you know, like government resources out of the economy, you know, like is going to be harmful to the recovery.
Yes, well, two things. You know, first of all, there's a large group of people, including us here at the Heritage Foundation, who don't believe that government take stuff in or out of the economy, that there's always money in the economy, that all government stimulus does is take water from one end of the pool and put it in the other in a less efficient manner. With the other part of your question is I think most of the cuts that the deficit commission identified were cuts that happened in the future. For example, raising the Social Security retirement age down the line, you know, keeping Social Security the way it is now for most people, but you know, in 5-10 years to start mean testing funding. You know, those would all be cuts that would happen in the future, but would still provide, you know, a credible promise on cutting spending.
All right. Thanks a lot for talking with me. Good discussion. I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to add.
No, I think we're up at 45 minutes, and it's been fun.
Great, great. Well, you take care and happy holidays.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Okay, bye.